It's 20 days into the new year, and U.S. foreign policy rhetoric has escalated.
One of the shocks for so many leaders at the moment, so many governments around the world, is that this year, 2026, is much more radical than even last year, 2025.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, a year of President Trump around the world. And in Venezuela, people are struggling to afford basic necessities. A reporter investigates.
You're telling me that the minimum wage is less than $1.
Yeah, it's $0.4.
One mayor is talking up his city's safety record.
We are safer than Paris, than Berlin, more than 2.5 times safer than New York.
And a solar storm lights up the skies. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you so much for joining us today. Marco Werman is off. In Venezuela, there are two big questions right now. The first is what you see in the headlines. What is the country's political future after the ouster of former President Nicolas Maduro? The other is the more urgent for Venezuelans, how to make ends meet. The oil-rich country used to be one of Latin America's wealthiest. It had a thriving middle class. Today, most people live on meager wages. The world's Tibi Saizea reports from Venezuela.
On a recent morning in Caracas, I asked an old friend to take me to the supermarket and show me what shopping looks like now.
Right now we are in the meat section of the supermarket. We are holding a plate with some chicken.
About half a chicken, I would say, right?
Yeah.
And it's $7.3, US dollars.
Yeah, for half a chicken. Yeah.
And you're telling me that the minimum wage is less than $1.
Yeah, it's $0.4, and it's decreasing because of the inflation. So every day is less and less and less.
That 40-cent minimum wage applies to many health workers, teachers, university professors, and other public employees. In reality, most people manage to make more than that. The average is about $200 a month, but that's still far below the cost of basic living. So for most Venezuelans, there are two main ways to survive. One is remittances. About 30% of Venezuelans have left the country, so a lot of families rely on someone sending money from abroad. The other is the informal economy. On a recent morning, I met Patricia Moreno, a nurse who quit her job because it was not worth working for $3 a month.
Pinturas de uñas, bloqueador solar, perfumes, maquillaje, bisutería, cadena.
Now she sells nail polish, sunscreen, perfumes, jewelry, eggs, and snacks from a small stand in an open market in Caracas. She says she makes about $150 a month. The Venezuelan Finance Observatory, an independent economic research group, says you would need 3 times that amount simply to feed a family of 4 in Venezuela. This kind of poverty can be found in other parts of Latin America, especially in places like Haiti or Cuba. What makes Venezuela different is how recently this was one of the wealthiest countries in the region, a place with real economic mobility that once attracted hundreds of thousands of immigrants.
Between 2013 and 2021-22, the Venezuelan economy experienced a decline process so lasting and deep that the economy reduced its size up to 80%.
Omar Zambrano is a chief economist at a policy research and consulting firm in Caracas. He says government mismanagement, corruption, and U.S. sanctions caused the economy to fail. That collapse essentially erased Venezuela's middle class. Arturo Marcano, a civil engineer in southern Venezuela, knows that well. He says he's worked on some of the most ambitious infrastructure projects in the country.
Tuve la oportunidad de formarme en el exterior porque el gobierno ofrecía becas.
He took advantage of government scholarships to train in the United Kingdom. And when he came back home, he found a good job at a Venezuelan company, bought a house for his family. They owned two cars and had a pension plan.
Los salarios eran muy buenos, pero no solamente eso. A mí me pagaban la vivienda.
But those opportunities collapsed with the economy.
No ha habido proyectos, prácticamente proyectos grandes, no hay ninguno que se haya desarrollado en el país.
Marcano says there have been virtually no major infrastructure projects in Venezuela in recent years. Along with the projects, his pay and benefits disappeared, and eventually so did his pension.
La pensión mensual es menos de un dólar para una persona como yo que trabajé 30 años ahí.
My pension is less than a dollar per month after working there for more than 30 years, he says. So instead of retiring comfortably, Marcano and his family started a small cookie shop to get by. Luis Gonzalez, an agronomic engineer, tells a similar story. He worked for decades in the private sector. Now the government only pays him a special bonus, so he gets about $45 a month. For him, one of the steepest costs is healthcare.
Solamente el seguro de gastos médicos cuesta $800 por mes para los dos.
Because free public hospitals are in shambles, many people feel forced to pay for private care. In their case, insurance costs $800 a month for a couple of seniors. Their three daughters, who live abroad, cover this cost. But for years, Gonzalez has leaned on a different skill to make extra money. His voice. Every week, he sings at a church to bring in a little more income. And he prays that the recent deals with the U.S. will bring enough economic stability to allow Venezuela to focus on a real political transition. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Caracas, Venezuela.
London is one of the safest cities in the Western world, so says the city's mayor, Sadiq Khan. Khan makes his case using new police statistics showing that homicide rates in the British capital are lower than they have been in a decade. But some say homicide numbers do not tell the whole story. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Berry, explains.
Sadiq Khan has been doing a lot of interviews this past week, and there's one thing he says again and again.
We are safer than Paris, than Berlin, more than 2.5 times safer than New York, 5 times safer than LA, 12 times safer than Chicago. Every US state has a higher homicide rate than London. And I think
the fact that Khan is drawing comparisons between London and cities across the US is maybe not so surprising when you hear what the US president has been saying about London and Mayor Khan recently.
He's a terrible mayor. And look at the crime you have in London. My mother loved London. She loved that city. She'd always talk about, that was a different London than you have today. Yeah. Today you have people being stabbed in the
97 people were killed in London last year. That's a drop of 60% over the last two decades. Khan says that's partly a reflection of the work done by the city's violence reduction unit, which he set up 6 years ago to try and prevent young people being drawn into criminal gangs. Ethan Bell is the director of a grassroots crime prevention programme in East London called Be Heard As One.
We do mentoring, we also do community outreach and support. We also do intervention groups, we work with mental health of young people, we look at family support.
Bell's own experience as a teenager in the city, where he had plenty of run-ins with the police, helps him connect with young people, he says. He knows how easy it is to be groomed by criminal gangs. Sometimes, he says, it's just because the gangs are there when your own family don't seem to be around.
Often these young people have a resentment for their family because cognitively they don't really understand the process of their parents having to go to work. All they're seeing is, you're not there for me. These people are there for me. When I need someone, I can pick up the phone and call them. When I'm hungry, I can pick up the phone and call them. So of course I'm going to do what they say because they're not grooming me, they're looking after me.
The drop in homicides is good news for London, Bell says, but non-fatal assaults, particularly knife attacks, are still a big issue. And some of these attacks never get reported, he says.
I had a young person that I've worked with directly who got stabbed. He said he didn't go to the hospital that he went to before because they know him and they will call the police. So he went to the hospital out of town and they didn't report it because he managed to make up an excuse that he felt changing his bike and the puncture thing went in his arm.
They don't go to the police because they don't trust them, Bell says, and they fear retribution from other gang members. Lack of trust has been an ongoing problem for London's Met Police, says Farah Naz. Her niece, Zara Alina, was sexually assaulted and killed in 2022.
When Zara was murdered 3.5 years ago, there were 3 other women that were pursued by the murderer. None of those women reported him to the police.
Alina was walking home late one night in Ilford in East London. She was 33 and studying law at the time, Naz says.
She's the only daughter of my sister, her best friend, and she was looking forward to having a child, looking forward to settling down, looking forward to consolidating her career, and she was the light in our family.
Naz says she welcomes the latest Met Police report, but the findings don't change how many people living in London feel.
Of course, whilst it's incredibly important that homicide figures have gone down, we also have to remember the other part of the landscape, that women still are changing their behaviours to be safe, that harassment figures have gone up.
Official figures show a 10% increase in sexual offences reported to the police last year compared to the previous 12 months. Minor crimes like shoplifting and phone theft are also an ongoing issue. Still, the way some presenters on right-wing news networks like GB News talk about the British capital, you might think the city was on the verge of collapse.
Our capital city, once the greatest on earth, has descended into a knife crime hellhole where people are getting stabbed in the or worse. That is a fact. It is.
And on social media, the number of posts questioning whether London is safe has also shot up.
The proportion of these types of posts has increased quite drastically over the last 2, 3, 4 years, in fact.
Mark Hill, a lecturer at King's College London, analysed posts criticising the city on Reddit, one of the most popular social media platforms in Britain. He says it's impossible to tell who's posting the comments, but the more negative they are, the greater the chance they'll go viral, and that can influence public opinion. Still, Hill says, framing London as unsafe has been a part of Britain's culture wars for a very long time.
London being presented as a failed state, a failed city, a dangerous place by particular people on the right. This has been going on. I moved to London about 20 years ago, and this is the London's place within this debate is not a brand new phenomenon.
And how you view London might well depend on where you live. A new poll out this month found 61% of people across Britain believe the capital is not a safe place to be. But when Londoners were asked, it was a very different result. 2/3 said the capital is safe, and more than 80% said they feel secure living in their own London neighbourhoods. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
We have a kind of fun note for you now about trash talk. It is timeless. That's the main takeaway from the graffiti of the ancient city of Pompeii, where people used to write on a 90-foot corridor through the city's theater district. Most of the scribblings cannot be read on the air. They are that graphic, but I will give you a relatively tame example. Quote, "I hope your hemorrhoids rub together so much that they hurt worse than they ever have before." Gross. But inventive, I guess. There are also love notes and lust notes, even political messages. Well, technology is giving us access to more Pompeii graffiti than ever before. Researchers from the Sorbonne University in Paris and the University of Quebec in Montreal have developed a new 3D digital platform to visualize and annotate the writing on this very old wall. Among the new revelations, a drawing of a gladiator and a declaration of love. Overall, the team captured 300 pieces of graffiti. 79 of those had never been seen before. You're listening to The World.
Right now, we are living through some of the most tumultuous political times our country has ever known. I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll try to make sense of what's happening alongside politicians and thinkers like Cory Booker, Nancy Pelosi, Liz Cheney, Tim Walz, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Newt Gingrich, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Charlemagne the God, and so many more. That's all in the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. European leaders are pushing back today against President Trump's threats to seize control of Greenland. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, French President Emmanuel Macron warned the White House against bullying longstanding allies in Western Europe.
Competition from the United States of America through trade agreements that undermine our export interests demand maximum concessions and openly aim to weaken and subordinate Europe, combined with an endless accumulation of new tariffs that are fundamentally unacceptable, even more so when they are used as leverage against territorial sovereignty.
Macron said that new tariffs Trump has threatened on European exports could lead to major retaliation from the European Union. Ursula von der Leyen also spoke in Davos. The president of the European Commission issued a reminder that the U.S. and EU just reached a trade agreement last July.
A deal is a deal. And when friends shake hands, it must mean something.
It is a geopolitical debacle that would have been hard to imagine under previous U.S. presidents. Today marks 1 year since Trump took office, and we're getting a global perspective on all that has changed in the last 12 months. For that, we turned to David Rennie. He is the geopolitics editor and a columnist for The Economist. I started our conversation with a tough ask. David, I want to start with one word, or maybe a phrase, if you were to sum up Trump's second term foreign policy in one word or phrase, what would it be?
Dominance.
Dominance. And how has that taken shape in the global economy?
One of the threads that runs through so much of what he has done this year, whether it's in Venezuela, whether it's what he's threatening to do in Greenland, whether it's his approach to tariff wars with trade partners, is a belief that showing American dominance and showing his dominance personally is the right thing to do. And I think one of the shocks for so many leaders at the moment, so many governments around the world, is that just as they had got used to the idea that the second Trump term was much more radical, much more aggressive than the first, that the people who had restrained Donald Trump in the first term were not there this time around, I think leaders are also now realizing that this year, 2026, and we're, you know, only 20 days in, is much more radical than even last year, 2025, that Donald Trump is a man in a hurry who feels essentially unconstrained.
So we have all been spending a lot of time thinking and talking about the changes that you just mentioned. I want to know, in terms of how the global economy works day to day, how much has changed in the first year of the Trump second administration?
A tremendous amount. Go ask countries like Australia or Singapore that actually do exactly what Donald Trump wants. They have a trade deficit with America. They buy more American stuff. They've been hit with a tariff too. There is a sense now that the world needs to understand that everyone is going to be paying a baseline tariff of maybe 10 or more percent on everything they try and sell into America, because Donald Trump is incredibly confident that tariffs that he imposed last year, particularly if you remember that big ceremony in the White House garden on Liberation Day in April.
With the big chart.
With the big chart about the reciprocal tariffs, including, you know, islands that only have penguins on, and everyone was sort of scratching their heads trying to work out where these crazy numbers came from. There were predictions of disaster. And to be fair, The Economist, the magazine I work for, we said there was likely to be a gigantic and very damaging trade war. Now, I was just in Washington a few days ago interviewing the U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer. You know, I admitted to him, we thought there was going to be more damage from these tariffs than was the case. And the big reason that we got it wrong was that we thought lots and lots of countries would retaliate, that they would hit back. And in fact, the big shock of last year, I think, economically, certainly in terms of trade, was how so many very, very large trade blocs, whether you're talking about the European Union, other big trade partners, they basically folded because they understood that if you retaliate against Donald Trump, he's just going to come after you with more. Now, the thing that is now very destabilizing to the world economy is that there are a couple of big players, above all China, that did hit back, and in hitting back, demonstrated to the world, and I think to Donald Trump's surprise, that actually his boasts that he controls all the cards, that trade wars are easy and quick to win, that they're not true. China last year stunned the world by threatening to withhold critical minerals, rare earths, that China essentially completely dominates, not just the mining, but also in many cases the processing of these things. And suddenly American car companies, American electronics companies were screaming to the White House that they were weeks away from having to stop production. And Donald Trump basically caved. I was in China a couple of times last year, and they were, by the end of the year, extremely confident that they had Donald Trump's number.
So what's the bottom line in terms of how healthy the economy is or isn't after a year of these trade war policies? You said that the impact was not as bad as you had originally predicted.
We thought that tariff wars and trade wars were all about economics. We learned under Donald Trump's 2025 behavior that he thinks of tariffs as a kind of super weapon. That you know, if you look at what he did last year, he threatened Mexico with tariffs if they didn't put more water into the Rio Grande. He threatened Brazil with tariffs if they jailed their former president, Jair Bolsonaro.
And of course, what we're seeing now with Europe.
Yeah, and he's threatening Europe with tariffs if they just try and defend Denmark's ownership of Greenland. So what are we seeing? We're seeing European leaders, led by people like the French president Macron, saying we have to now be ready to retaliate. Even if this is not a good idea in terms of trade, we have no choice. The lesson of 2025 is that if you try and placate Donald Trump and you try and avoid his wrath, he's just emboldened. And so I think that the geopolitical risks of a major trade war are really, really high right now.
Interesting. I'm speaking with David Rennie, geopolitics editor and a columnist for The Economist. I want to talk a little bit more about China. We have covered on the show the many ways in which China is trying to step in as a more reliable partner for countries, as the U.S. is seen as an increasingly unreliable partner. How much has the balance of power changed in that respect?
Look, China is clearly telling a lot of countries that it is a more predictable and reliable partner. And in a lot of the world, I think that is heard with a lot of relief. China's offer to Western allies of Donald Trump is a little less comforting. So the Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, for sure, he went to Beijing recently, first visit in a long time after icy relations, and he talked about a strategic partnership with China. All of that is fine. But it's really quite limited, because if you are a mid-sized liberal democracy like Canada and you want to hedge against a bullying Donald Trump, China is only somewhat of a help.
That's David Rennie of The Economist. Stay tuned for the rest of our conversation after the break. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We are continuing our conversation with David Rennie, the geopolitics editor and a columnist for The Economist. We talked next about whether the decoupling of the U.S. and Chinese economies seemed far-fetched.
There is a sense in which China is decoupling slowly, and the investment flows are slowing down in each direction. But one of the big surprises, to add to the long list of surprises of Trump's second term, is that he doesn't sound like a China hawk in the way that you might have expected, certainly if you think back to his first election campaign in 2016. I was in the States back then. I was our Washington bureau chief. I covered the campaign. I interviewed Donald Trump about China. And back then, if you remember, he was talking about you know, China stealing all the jobs, and he was going to, this was the biggest theft in history. Now, particularly after China used its rare earths weapon against America last summer and autumn and really intimidated Donald Trump, you see Donald Trump talking about wanting to have a good relationship with China, wanting to do a big, beautiful trade deal with China, and China basically still being bent on self-reliance and not being dependent on an America that they do not trust an inch.
Interesting. I want to turn to Europe now. The relationship between the U.S. and Europe used to be something that you could kind of take for granted being solid. What does it mean to the world economy that is no longer true?
It is absolutely certainly no longer taken for granted. And it's gone so far beyond American grumbling about NATO members from Europe not spending enough on defense. Because, you know, remember, though, we heard those from people like Barack Obama. This is different. This is new. The idea that Donald Trump is threatening to say that he needs to have Greenland as territory for his own psychological happiness, that he is not content to have American bases in Greenland, which is obviously part of Denmark, European ally in the EU and NATO. He's saying that unless he owns it, it doesn't really count, that you have his cabinet secretaries going out and saying that, you know, even a long lease on Greenland, even bases in places like Europe, doesn't give you real security because no one is willing to really take care of the security of somewhere if they don't own it. Well, if you are Europe, you're thinking, well, if you're not willing to defend somewhere unless you own it, what does that mean about all of our expectations about being, you know, home to American bases, being America's security partner?
What does NATO
in
mean
the economic
anymore?
Sphere? Yeah. And you know, when the Danish prime minister said, if you attack Greenland, that's the end of NATO. I think initially some European partners thought, you know, or maybe that's a bit exaggerated. But I think if you see right now the language coming out of European governments, particularly after Donald Trump threatened to tariff those governments that had sent troops to show kind of that they can secure Greenland against these supposed threats from, you know, Russia and China, I think Europeans are in a very different place this week, even compared to last week. And that has economic consequences. You know, I know that people in the Trump administration like to talk about Europe as old and tired and finished, but Europe is still one of the world's richest consumer markets. It's enormously important to big American companies. So when Donald Trump was very first re-elected, I remember some countries in the global south sounding actually quite complacent and even mocking Western liberal democracies like Britain and saying, oh, you're such babies. You thought that America was a good country. You thought that America was benign. We always knew that this is a brutal, transactional, dog-eat-dog world. And we handled Donald Trump just fine in his first presidency. And it'll be fine this time. That was the message from people like diplomats from India around the time that he was being inaugurated a year ago. Now, you go around the world at some of the big players in the global south this time, countries like India, South Africa, and Brazil, the past year has been extraordinarily bruising for them. The Indian leader, Narendra Modi, his supposedly close relationship with Donald Trump did not protect him from being hit with tariffs, with having the humiliation of Donald Trump claiming that he alone stopped what he said was going to be a nuclear war between India and Pakistan when they had one of their regular conflicts and skirmishes. You've seen the South Africans being singled out for extraordinary humiliation, with the president of South Africa humiliated, being accused of practicing white genocide against Afrikaner farmers in the Oval Office on TV. You've seen down in Brazil, you've seen the Brazilians, their relationship with Donald Trump, really shaken by Donald Trump's overt support for the former right-wing leader Jair Bolsonaro, who was on trial for attempting to overthrow an election. You're seeing Donald Trump decisively intervening, even in places like Argentina, where American support for the right-wing leader down in Argentina, Javier Milei, probably saved them from a kind of currency implosion a few months ago. And so Donald Trump is actually playing in the global south in a way that people are not expected. And above all, if the story of this presidency, second presidency, is that this year is so much more radical than the last, the first days of this year 2025, we saw the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela and described as a demonstration that America seeks to have total dominance in the Western Hemisphere. And you see most governments in Latin America are very shocked by what just happened. I think in some cases deeply disappointed by what has followed, with the Maduro regime basically remaining in place and America's only interest being in sort of extracting oil profits, but under no doubt that Donald Trump's vision of a kind of 19th century sphere of influence over the whole of the Americas, he's not just joking.
David, when we talk about geopolitics, we say things like the post-World War II world order seems to be over. That feels rather final, or at least like a chapter ending. When we talk about economics and how economics works globally, is it more likely to return to some previous state once President Trump is no longer in office?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can be, if you look at narrowly at the economic parts of the post-45 global order, you know, America was willing to play pretty rough at certain moments. You know, when Richard Nixon tore up the original agreement to have kind of fixed exchange rates and to use the gold standard to kind of fix global currencies, when the Americans leaned on the Japanese to completely revalue their currency in the Plaza Accord, you know, America has played rough several times since 1945. So the financial economic part of the global order was always somewhat, people were pretty realistic about America pursuing its own interests. But I think what is clearly absolutely over is the global order that really kind of the high point was around the time of the presidency of Bill Clinton, or maybe George W. Bush, the time when we were admitting China to the World Trade Organization, where globalization was seen as an unmistakable win for America and American corporations, that the idea that, you know, some jobs went to China from America or went to Mexico, but it didn't matter because America was always going to be so far ahead in the next important industry or the next advanced technology that it could afford to let the efficiency and economic efficiency decide where factories were built, where productions was sited, where supply chains ran. And that was enormously profitable for a lot of countries. It lifted countries like China out of poverty in spectacular ways. It transformed, you know, much of Asia. But it is clear that Donald Trump believes that that was a terrible deal for America, and he is dismantling that order in ways that are really, really consequential, and I don't think are coming back. The fact that America is now no longer seen as guided by the interests of its largest companies or by pure economic efficiency, that nationalist American populist politics go beyond Donald Trump. They have now essentially taken over a Republican Party. Some of the Republican senators may not like what's happening, but they're not willing to stand up to Donald Trump. On the Democratic side, the Democratic Party is clearly not about to sign any free trade agreement with any country on earth anytime soon if they get back into power. And so for the rest of the world, the idea that America is hostile to free trade and increasingly hostile to globalization and very focused on the American national interest, that is an enormous change, because it means that, you know, as a country that wants to take advantage of globalization, you can no longer expect investments and supply chains to flow your way just because you're a good place to do business, just because you're efficient, just because you're competitive. You understand that politics is going to direct supply chains. Things are getting very fragmented, very complicated, very political. There's a lot of hedging. There's a lot of duplication. And so globalization's kind of golden age, I think that, so the 90s, 2000s, whatever your listeners think of globalization, it did generate a tremendous amount of wealth, and it did lift a lot of people from poverty in countries where I've been posted. And it's not coming back. And that's an enormous, enormous shift.
David, I would be remiss if I did not ask you about Vladimir Putin and President Trump's increasingly friendly relationship with him. What do you make of the larger global significance of that?
It's a real sign of how insanely busy the news cycle is at the moment, that we've hardly thought about Ukraine and how that war might end. Although right now, people in Ukraine are suffering the most appalling winter as Russian missiles and drones take out their energy and their power supplies. But there is going to be a reckoning in Ukraine before too long. Ukraine is not doing that well in this war. And there is the constant threat that a really bad peace deal is going to be imposed in some way on Ukraine by America because Donald Trump fundamentally seems to believe that Vladimir Putin's right to dictate his kind of security order over his neighborhood is a legitimate argument. And Donald Trump, most shockingly, when it comes to how the Ukraine war has progressed since he came back into office a year ago, the most shocking aspect of Donald Trump's approach to the Ukraine war since he came back into office a year ago has been when Donald Trump has essentially seemed to endorse Vladimir Putin's worldview, that he says that Ukraine should never have fought back, it should never have tried to defend itself, that a larger country like Russia, when it attacks a smaller country, it's foolish for the smaller country to imagine it has cards to play with. That might makes right imperial worldview that we know is Vladimir Putin's worldview. It is really profoundly shocking to hear Donald Trump endorse that. And then we've seen his special presidential envoy, Steve Witkoff, paying visit after visit to Moscow, talking to carefully chosen Kremlin officials whose speciality is business deals and investments, like Kirill Dmitriev. And that signals Vladimir Putin's pitch to the Trump administration, which is, let's not only have peace, let's have a peace that makes everyone rich. Wouldn't that be a better world? And that seems to be something that deeply appeals to Donald Trump, the idea that war is bad for business and that peace could be enormously profitable and profitable for America. Vladimir Putin seems to have understood that extremely well and is dangling deals that would supposedly make American oil companies and others rich in Russia, and to the alarm of Ukraine and also Ukraine's allies in Europe, those arguments really seem to be working.
David Rennie is the geopolitics editor and a columnist for The Economist. Tonight, people in many parts of the Northern Hemisphere will see the Northern Lights on display, making the sky glow purple, pink, and green. That's the Aurora Borealis. People in the Southern Hemisphere are seeing the Southern Lights, the Aurora Australis. These are side effects of a major solar storm underway right now. Ryan French is an astrophysicist based in Colorado at the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics. I asked him to explain what is happening with the sun in this solar storm.
Essentially, on Sunday, we had a large solar flare on the sun, and this released a burst of plasma and particles which traveled from the sun all of their way to Earth. And yesterday, a little under 24 hours from this event from the sun, these impacted Earth. So this eruption from the sun slams into Earth's magnetic field. This causes it to wobble. This generates the northern lights and the southern lights down here on the ground as these high-energy particles collide with the atmosphere above us. The second part of this story is the sun also produced a solar radiation storm, where instead of these plasma structures coming from the sun, it fires high energy protons and electrons, and these slam into our atmosphere. And this is another measurable event that is currently ongoing.
So you mentioned that there are two things happening right now. One is causing the auroras that we're seeing in the northern and southern hemispheres. And then the other is what we could call a severe solar radiation storm.
Yes.
What makes it severe?
So severe is kind of a technical word here. There's an official ranking which comes from NOAA, which ranks these events from an S1 level to S5. And on Monday, we experienced that severe level, which is a level 4 out of 5. And this is the first time we've measured that since 2003.
So there can be some repercussions on Earth from this sort of thing, right? What can happen? And did any of that happen so far?
That's correct. Yeah. So with the solar radiation storm specifically, there is a radiation hazard to astronauts in space, in the International Space Station. So during this period of time, there's high energy radiation flowing above us. So all spacewalks are cancelled. Astronauts are not allowed to go to the outer regions of the space station. They have to stay in the middle of the space station where they have the most protection around them. Flights as well, pilots, cabin crew are also vulnerable to higher radiation levels during these events, especially near the North and South Pole. So interestingly, when I looked at the flight radar yesterday, all of these flights are being diverted to lower latitudes away from these higher radiation zones.
And was that out of consideration for safety or something to do with navigation? I know these solar storms can also impact, for example, GPS satellites.
They absolutely can, yes. Monday, The redirection of the flights would have primarily been due to a human body safety aspect. Huh. The interruption with GPS and navigation, things like that, happen with sort of larger geomagnetic storms. There was an event back in May 2024 where a bunch of GPS communication was lost for days at a time, and this had impacts to the US agricultural industry.
I remember that. It was like the John Deere tractors, right?
It was, certainly was. I've not heard of anything like that coming out from this one, but if something did happen, we might not hear about it for a few weeks.
Going back to what I think most people might be interested in most from this conversation, what does the forecast look like for Northern Lights tonight? Where might people be able to see them?
So we've definitely passed the peak of the events now. The peak was Monday, happened whilst Europe was at nighttime. So Europe got this amazing Northern Lights show. By the time North America rotated into darkness, things had died down a little bit. It did pick up again this morning, just before sunrise for much of the US and Canada. Mm. Tonight, as I speak right now, for Europeans, you have a good chance of seeing the aurora again. For North Americans, it depends on how long it persists for. If you live in a northern state, you might have a good chance of seeing the aurora again, but it just depends on what happens in the next 12 hours or so.
And what about the southern lights? Are those getting farther north than they often do?
Absolutely. The southern lights move further north just as the northern lights move further south. The reason why you don't typically hear about the southern lights as much is because for the southern lights to reach a populated area, they have to come quite far north. Mm. So even to get to, say, New Zealand, Tasmania, the bottom of Chile and Argentina, you need quite a lot of boost in these events to get the southern lights up that far. I do think places like New Zealand and Tasmania would have seen the aurora, or they have seen the aurora. Will they see it again? It again depends on the timing of this thing and when nighttime rolls around for those locations.
Ryan French is an astrophysicist in Colorado. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Syria, a ceasefire officially went into effect today between Kurdish-led forces that once controlled about a quarter of Syria and the Syrian government. The agreement would fold the Kurdish-led forces, known as the SDF, into the Syrian army and transfer control of most of the land that it used to hold. That's according to Middle East historian and Professor Amr Al-Azam.
The Kurdish majority population areas would be given a certain amount of autonomy to take care of themselves. But ultimately, the administration of the region would have to fall under the central government in Damascus.
The agreement was finalized on Sunday after Syrian government forces pushed Kurdish forces out of much of their territory. It is similar in terms to a previous ceasefire agreed to last year. Its exact status, though, is tenuous. Yesterday, fighting broke out around two SDF prisons where members of the Islamic State are held. And Amr Al-Azam told me earlier today that many details about integrating Kurdish forces into the Syrian military still need to be worked out.
The merging within the armed forces, would they merge as independent units within the army, which is what the Kurds were demanding, or would they just be individuals, which is what the Syrian government was demanding? The Kurds were insisting on maintaining control of the border crossings in the areas in the eastern part of the country. And again, the government was insisting, no, you cannot control these have to go back into government. This has to be under full government administration, so on and so forth. And this is what basically was essentially stopping the process of implementation.
So what happened over the weekend was basically the enactment by force of what had been agreed to previously. So the SDF finally has handed over control of the territory that it held in the north because it had to. Yeah,
exactly.
So is this just the latest step in Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara consolidating power?
Essentially, yes. And that had always been his stated goal. Ahmed al-Shara had always insisted that the rule and authority of the state had to extend across all areas of Syria, no matter what.
So this ceasefire that was agreed to over the weekend is supposed to take effect today. What is the status of it right now?
So essentially, this ceasefire gives Muslim Abdi, the head of the SDF, 4 days to essentially come up with a full implementation plan in terms of the Syrian army and the administrative integration of the the managing of the province.
There have been these clashes, though, around prisons in the north of Syria where Islamic State affiliates are held. What has been happening there? And is it clear if someone is indeed in control of these prisons at the moment?
Right, yes. The two big prisons are Al-Hol, which is sort of up in the north, and the Shaddadi prison. There was an escape of some anywhere between 120 to 200 prisoners, and apparently 81 had been recaptured so far by the government forces. So the government is trying to make sure that this doesn't happen. But the main conflict is over, you know, essentially the SDF are saying, you know, we're protecting these prisons, and they're using it as a card to justify why they need protection, they need support from the international. In fact, there was a call for the international coalition to come and help them, you know, prevent these prisons from falling into the hands of the government. The government at the same time is saying, no, no, we're more than capable of taking over that role of running those prisons. So essentially they're pulling that card out of the SDF's hands,
yeah.
So they don't use it as an excuse to not hand over the prisons.
So we've been talking about kind of the military and militia activity here, but what does this loss of territory for the Kurdish forces mean more broadly for the Kurdish minority in Syria?
You know, there was a very interesting decree announced on Sunday, Presidential Decree 13, which was, you know, groundbreaking in many ways, and a very clever move by Ahmed Sharah. And essentially, it recognized and guaranteed Kurdish cultural rights, citizenship, language, and it recognized Nowruz as an official holiday. This is a very important national day for the Kurds. So in a way, he gave them the rights, you know, the cultural rights, etc. But at the same time said, it's over. You know, you have to now hand over your territory. You have to integrate into the army. You have to relinquish control over the border crossings, and so on and so forth. You have to become part of the state. You know, you have to, you know, you have to be Syrians. So I think the question for them is now, you know, who accepts it and how it's accepted. And for the rest of us, it's just hoping that this happens with the least amount of bloodshed, that it does not devolve into some major conflict. It's very important that in this change of sort of changing landscape, if you will, that the civil peace is maintained.
One of the biggest questions for the new Syrian government, Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa, after he overthrew the Assad regime a little over a year ago, was whether, you know, he could bring this country with different communities, different cultures, different religions into one country. Is the Kurdish minority, and was the SDF the biggest last group that needed to be brought fully into the new Syria?
I think certainly it was one of the biggest in terms of potential threat to such a plan. And now that's been sort of dealt with, I'd say there is very little left to prevent what vision Ahmed Sharaa has for the new Syria that he anticipates and hopes to build. So, yes, with that sort of obstacle removed, they're on their way to consolidating that win soon.
Amr al-Azam is a professor of Middle East history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. We leave you today on a hopeful note. There is a moose in Romania. This is based on multiple sightings this winter, now confirmed by rewilding specialists. They went to document the presence of the long-absent species in the country for themselves. The return of moose to Romania is being seen as a win for biodiversity there. It's still not clear where this particular moose came from, but Ukraine and Poland are both home to moose populations. An organization called Rewilding Romania plans to work with local authorities to monitor and protect this moose. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us back here again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.